IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Dr. Carl, good morning to you and happy Australia Day. I believe it's a big celebration.
Yes, all across the country. It began as a fundraiser in 1915 during the First World War, and the date has changed several times. And at the moment, the date is that when the first fleet sailed out of Botany Bay and went a dozen kilometres up the coast to land in Sydney Harbour, one of the 12 best harbours in the whole world.
And I was telling listeners earlier that apparently if you visit a beach a day in Australia, it'll take you 27 years to visit them all.
Well, Australia is pretty big, not as big as Africa, but we do have beaches all over the place. So I'm imagining from what you're saying that Africa doesn't have as many beaches.
Well, yeah, I don't know. It probably does if you take the whole continent, but South Africa certainly doesn't have as many as that. It does have and has beautiful beaches, but those numbers it doesn't have. Another question we were asking is why so many little things in Australia want to kill you?
Humans were relatively late to this continent, arriving maybe 60, maybe 100,000 years ago. And so we haven't had a long time of living with those creatures. And yes, it does seem the popular image given out to the rest of the world is that as you drive out of the airport, various man-eating crocodiles
yes,
will come crawling out of the air-conditioning vent.
Only if you've survived border
funnel web spiders.
If you've survived border control, that is.
Yeah, well, they're pretty nasty too. But remarkably, very few people get killed by creatures in Australia. And I think with sharks, the number of people killed worldwide each year averages about 5, which is a much smaller number than the number of sharks killed by humans.
Yeah, absolutely right. Let's talk about Theobald Smith. Who was he?
Theobald Smith was a scientist way back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he came out with three things. One thing that he came out with was the name. He discovered the germ called Salmonella, the one that kills people through food poisoning, and he named it very kindly after his boss, David E. Salmon. Secondly, he came across the concept of anaphylaxis, where your body's immune system tries to kill you and you can fight off with a shot of adrenaline. A lot of people know about this. They have the so-called EpiPens. And thirdly, he came up with a concept of diminishing virulence between a pathogen and a host. And it is saying that, well, if the nasty germ tries to kill the host, it'll end up in a bad place. And so it'll become more mild with time. Mm. And he noticed this happening in the northern and southern Texas cattle. And so he applied it around the world. And people believed that until around the 1980s, when we realized that with diseases like smallpox and malaria, they did not ever get less nasty and are still as nasty now as they were in the beginning. And AIDS has never got less nasty. So it depends on the individual circumstance. It is not automatic that a disease will become more mild with time. It depends on other things like what's the host that carries it, the vector that carries it from here to there. So if it's a mosquito, does a mosquito survive better by attacking living people or dead people? There's a whole lot of factors involved. So for the people who are saying that the COVID virus will become more mild, it might not. Probably won't.
Fascinating. Really, really interesting because, we often hear of this that if a virus or something like that is too aggressive, it kills the host and then it can't transmit to another. So I guess it follows that, he was following that type of logic.
Yes. What they've left out with that simple logic is that in many cases before the host, a human, dies, they can then transmit the disease to another person.
In any event,
so from the virus's point of view, it doesn't matter if the host dies because they've already transmitted the disease, which is all they want to increase their numbers, going by so-called evolutionary theory.
All right, let's talk about 5G. Can it potentially interfere with aeroplane safety and plane landings?
Potentially, yes, in America, but not in the other 40 countries or so around the world
that
are already rolling out 5G. And it's related to a bit of aeroplane instrumentation called the radio altimeter. It's a little radio unit on the bottom of the airplane. It fires a radio beam down to the ground, waits for how long it takes to come back, and it measures the distance. It has a range of around 2,000 feet. So it's certainly no good at altitude, which is at 30,000 feet, but it's absolutely essential for coming in to land in bad weather where you haven't got ground visibility. You absolutely need that thing all the way down. And the reason that it's a problem only in America, but not the other 40 countries, is that firstly, in America, the power of the 5G units is 2.5 times greater than everywhere else in the world, the power of the towers. Mm. Secondly, in America, they radiate in all directions instead of being beam-formed to keep the output of the 5G tower close to the ground. But the main reason is that in America, the gap between the radio altimeter and the 5G is very small. So the radio altimeter operates at 4.2 to 4.4 gigahertz. In America, 5G is allowed to come all the way up to 4, and that 0.2 is not enough of a gap. The rest of the world is only allowed to come up to 3.7 or 3.8, and that gives you a bigger, safer gap. So they're still playing with it. It seems to be poor planning in America that has caused this situation.
That is absolutely fascinating.